Session number 26581.
14. We got you to the Air Ministry and you're dealing with operation requirements. So you were there until July 1964, so a year and a bit, a year and a half about. Now, why did you retire? Because you seem to have taken early retirement deliberately rather than been thrown out in the sense of coming to the end of your career. What was it that made you leave early?
I was really, in a way, a victim of circumstances. When I was promoted group captain in January 1960, it was at the same time that the armed forces came out with a new career structure. And the new career structure was that officers would be given the option of retiring at the age of 40 or going on, this is permanent commissioned officers, or going on to the age of 55, regardless of rank. Now, prior to that, retirement age had been fixed according to your rank. And as a group captain, the age for retirement was 50. Now, because I was promoted at the same time as this new career structure came out, along with all the other people promoted at that time, we were not assimilated to the new structure. The people who had been assimilated to it were those who were rather more senior in their ranks. The only way in which we could get assimilated to the new structure was by being promoted. So I found myself at the age of 45, when I first qualified for a basic pension, was that unless I got promoted, I would have to retire at 50. And at that age, my children would be university age, and it would be extremely difficult to consider retiring from service life and starting a new career at the age of 50. So I decided that it would probably be better to go at the age of 45. And I started shopping around quietly to see what kind of a job I might be able to get. At the same time, I had words with the Air Secretary at the Air Ministry, and said, I put to him my situation and said that if the chances of promotion were greater than even, I would stay on, but if they were less than even, I would have to apply to retire early. He said, well, give me a couple of weeks to look into this, which he did, and when I went back, he said, well, I've looked into your case, he said, and the best I can offer you is 40-60. So I said, well, in that case, I think I'd better go. So I put in my retirement, and I retired just after my 45th birthday and took up a job that I had already negotiated to be the general manager of Border Television up in Carlisle.
Now, how had you got that? I mean, we don't deal a lot with, we just sort of look at an outline of what happened to you afterwards, very briefly, but mainly how your RAF experiences and what you'd learned. How had you got a thing?
I saw the job advertised and applied for it. And went through the interview process and was offered the job.
Do you think your RAF experience has been valuable in getting that job?
I suppose it probably was, but there was also another element to it, and that was that in my youth, before I joined the RAF, I had always been much involved, as I think I mentioned, in stage management of the Dramatic Society, and before that, as a youngster, I had set up with an old silent projector that I got hold of, a cinema in a large outbuilding on the where we lived, and we and my colleagues ran a little cinema on a commercial basis. So I had been much interested in that kind of activity, and I think this possibly helped me.
Now, when you were in the post, there are two things. One, did you find it easy to acclimatise to the civilian lifestyle?
Well, actually, it was a question of learning, in a way, the hard way. I discovered Border Television, commercial television, had not been going very long. And Border Television had been set up by Robin Gill, It was a small company. In fact, Border Television is the smallest television company in the country. And when I arrived as the general manager up at Carlisle, because Robin Gill was living in London where the sales office was, the day after I arrived, Robin Gill put in his resignation because he'd been appointed as deputy managing director of ATV in the Midlands, a much larger company. And so I found myself, therefore, high and dry as the general manager, with the board saying, well, of course, you'll have to carry on till we get a new managing director, because regrettably, with your lack of experience, we can't consider you for being holding the position of managing director. And I realised, in fact, that I had been set up by Robin Gill, who simply had to have somebody available that, if he wanted to resign, he could hand over and get away without difficulty, which he did. The result to me was that for 3 months I was running the show, and then the new managing director turned up, who hadn't been, he'd been in television, but he hadn't been a managing director before, and I said to him we'd have to sort out what we were going to do, and he said, well, give me some time to think about it. And 3 months later he decided that he was going to live in Carlisle and he didn't want a general manager there, so I became redundant.
So you were only there?
I was there about, well, actually, after making me redundant, they allowed me to stay on until I got another job, and I had a secretary. So I got further experience. I applied for some 100 jobs from newspaper advertisements, which resulted in 10 interviews, which resulted in a job.
So you left Border Television in 65?
Yeah.
What was your new job?
My new job, and this was a very interesting situation, I first of all had applied for a job in the procurement division of the Ford Motor Company. And they called me for interview, and they said, well, you're not quite qualified for the sort of work we want, but you're the sort of person that we would very much like to have in the company. So would you like to be called back again when we've got some further thoughts to put to you? I said, yes. So I went back to Carlisle, and a couple of weeks later, I was back at Ford to be interviewed. And I was met at the station by Alan Bradley, who was a personnel officer, who took me along to the headquarters and up to the top floor at Brentwood and introduced me to the managing director, who was to interview me. Alan Bradley sat in an outside office. In the managing director's office at that time, when I went in, were two other directors. They'd obviously been having a discussion of some sort. So the three of them sat there whilst they interviewed me. And it was a very congenial interview, nothing terribly formal. We talked about this and that. One of them had been in the Air Force at one time, and all round we got on very well. And at the end of the interview, when the managing director started making sounds like, don't ring us, we'll ring you, one of the other directors said, well, we're all here, let's make a decision now. So I was wheeled out of the office and into the office of another director next door, one of the three on going to consider my future. And whilst I sat there, I thought to myself, well, they've committed themselves to making a decision, and it's going to be much easier for them to say, yes, we'll give you a job, than to say, well, we decided you're not suitable. And lo and behold, when they called me back, they said, yes, we decided to give you a job. In grade 12, which didn't mean anything to me at all, they said, we haven't got a specific job in mind, but as soon as something's sorted out, we'll offer it to you and see if it's what you want. So I left the office, and Alan Bradley, sitting outside, said, well, how did it go? And I said, well, they've offered me a job, grade 12, whatever that means. He said, they can't do that. That's not procedure. However, he was overruled. And I eventually went as the manager of a parts supply depot at Thurrock.
Now, you've dealt with your motor manufacturing career in the interviews, can you just to tell us how much value your RAF experience was in your career, or perhaps it was a handicap, I've no idea. Was it useful to you?
I think the great advantage of my service career was that it had taught me to take on new jobs without any previous experience and to recognize that that was a fairly normal thing to do. So when I got into industry, I had the same attitudes. It never crossed my mind that there was anything very difficult about any of it. It was just starting yet another job and generally being able to keep one step ahead of everybody else. In 1965, it wasn't all that long after the war, and as far as a lot of the staff were concerned, particularly the blue-collar staff, the fact that I was a retired group captain, they considered was a bit of kudos as far as the job was concerned. I didn't find myself in any way looked down upon.
And for the rest, you could just
perhaps
sum up what the rest
of them. Well, at Ford I went up fairly rapidly from being depot manager at Thurrock to the larger depot at Averley and then to being the programming and supply manager for the parts supply operation of Ford Motor Company. And then my boss was taken on by British Leyland to do a similar job there. And after he'd been there a month or two, he invited me to join him. So I went over and became the general manager of the parts supply operation of Austin Morris at Cowley. I'd been doing that job for about a year, and the managing director of British Leyland, George Turnbull, then invited me to become the director of production control for Austin Morris. So I went up to Longbridge and took over as the director of production control. Then the headquarters of British Leyland was set up, and I was then invited to become the director of production control of British Leyland. There was a further reorganisation, and I went across and became the director of traffic and transportation control, which was a new activity to rationalise all transport and personnel movements within the corporation. Regrettably, for various well-known reasons to me, the company went bust in December 1974 and I became redundant. Having become redundant, I was at this time age 56, I made contact with a colleague in the Ministry of Defence who was responsible for the rehabilitation of officers retiring from the Air Force. And I asked him if he had any jobs coming into his entree, and he said, well, there's an interesting one coming you might want to be interested in. The government of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia have written to the British government saying that they're building a new seat of power in Riyadh, and would the British government give them advice on the anti-terrorist countermeasures that should be put into this project? MI5 replied that they would very much like to do this, but if another king got assassinated, it might set up political problems. So they suggested setting up a nominee, and they would brief him, and he then would brief the project architects and so on. And that was the job I took on, and so I became a security engineering consultant. And this was, in many ways, quite a challenge, because I not only had to devise the security systems, both the electronic and physical systems, but produce the tender documents so that when it went out to tender, the security systems were designed and specified, and then to vet the contract submissions that were made, the tenders that were put in, and recommend who the subcontractor should be. This I did until eventually I retired, various times, because I thought I'd retired at the age of about 70. But at 77, I was asked by the people that were involved in developing the Greenwich Dome to do the security systems for the Greenwich Dome, which I did.
You have finally retired. You're not a consultant anymore.
No. I'm now 84.
And finally, you're very linked with some of the, well, certainly some of your old squadrons, aren't you? Can you just comment on your old, the links you have with your old comrades?
Yeah.
One of my more enjoyable retirement activities is to be the president of number 269 Squadron, Old Comrades Association. This Old Comrades Association has had annual reunion dinners without a break since the beginning of World War I, and next year we'll see our 83rd reunion. The squadron formed originally out of the Royal Naval Air Service, and some of our activities were at Eastleigh, Abbots Inch, Wick, Iceland.
We know about this. Yeah. Why is this important to you? I mean, why is it taking so much of it? Because it does take a lot of your time now.
Well, it's certainly because it keeps us all together. The fellowship of squadron life was extremely strong, and it carries on with very many people after they've left the services. They keep together and have a lot of nostalgia going over old times.
So the reunions are just great fun?
Well, they're fun, but we do a certain amount of welfare among it. We look after ourselves, and when anybody dies, we make sure that someone attends the funeral and that a donation is made or wreath supplied and so on. And if necessary, if any kind of welfare help is needed to people in hard circumstances, we assist. The Old Comrades Association is open to all ranks.
Thank you very much.